Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
Hello, I'm Mina Rizuki, and welcome to the Telegraph Audio Football Club. Today, the North London Derby takes centre stage and is declared the greatest fixture in world football by Jamie Redknapp. Is he right? We shall have the final say. Elsewhere in the Premier League, it's another weekend of disappointing results for Man United and Chelsea, and we'll be discussing which former legend is faring better in charge of their clubs and where they go from here. Plus, the best of the action from the Premier League, Europe, and of course, Scottish football. I guess we can't forget about that, right, JJ?
Yes. Why is okay. That so funny?
I have no idea why I just found that so funny. But I'm in the hosting chair, and don't worry, Tom Gibbs will be back, but he's taken the week off.
Clearly. It's very important these days, isn't it?
I know. Check that out.
Days off here, there, everywhere.
It's just me and you from the old guard, but we have an interesting face back in. Obviously, as always, Sam Dean, our youth prodigy.
How an interesting are you? Face. Yes. That is how I've been trying to style myself in recent months. So an interesting face. I'm pleased to be back. Thank you for having me.
And of course, we have Alistair, but we like to call you Ali, right?
Yeah, please, Ali. Only my mum calls me Alistair. So
oh, really? Is that only when she's angry?
No, just the whole time. She still thinks I'm Alistair, but I'm definitely Ali. So please, Ali.
Ali, and of course, we have JJ to discuss all types of tactics with us. I'm going to start with you, JJ. What is it about this derby, the North London derby, that is, that always allows it to deliver?
The two teams are very good. And I don't know, it's weird because there's not really any players from North London that are in there apart from Harry Kane. Is he in North London?
Yeah.
He is? There we go.
Harry Winks.
So Harry Winks. So I've been proven wrong already. But the...
Maitland-Niles.
Shut up.
Come on, Sam, another one.
Well, I think they're just two good teams. And I think what's nice about this derby is it lacks some of the venom you get in some other ones that spoils some of the play. But there's a real good... competitive aggression, I'll call it. So like the players are going right into tackles to try and win things, but because it's a top tier level of sport, it's a good standard of football and it's just entertaining, right? It's just fun to watch. There's always seems to change around in games. There's weird scorelines as well.
They're two good teams, but they're also two flawed teams, I think. I think that's why this game's been so entertaining for the last few years, because as we know, Arsenal are great going forward, but horrific at the back sometimes, and Spurs always go there and think, yeah, we can beat them, we're better than them, we'll give them a go, and they really sort of push for them and try and expose Arsenal's weaknesses, which in turn leaves Spurs open, and then goals happen and things happen and red cards happen, and then you combine that with all the sort of the atmosphere and the sort of cauldron of noise going around. I mean, yesterday the Emirates was genuinely like ringing.
You were there, right?
Yeah, it was genuinely loud, and it's to be honest, it's not that often that I can say that about the Emirates. So it does obviously affect the players, and they always say that you can feel it. And
so I think basically, what you're saying is the mediocrity of these two teams is why it's so fun to
watch.
Yeah,
I think their strengths
were better.
largely, yeah, I think their strengths and weaknesses sort of combine quite well to make it an open game. And it was interesting hearing Jose Mourinho talk afterwards about the match, basically saying it was a heart attack waiting to happen for a manager. Like the game's completely gone out the window, and. I think that's quite a sort of good indictment of what kind of match this is, with two teams trying to win the game and both with sort of obvious flaws and obvious strengths, and it sort of all comes together quite nicely.
I also think these are two teams that they're very good just behind the elite, and realistically they're not going to win anything major anytime soon. They're not going to win the league. And so there's just the bragging rights are so massive between Tottenham and Arsenal fans. Like, that's probably why the stadium was so loud yesterday. The Arsenal fans are so desperate to win that match just so they can say, and Spurs equally, just so they can say, yeah, but what happened in the last game to Arsenal fans? You haven't won anything in ages. Tottenham fans saying, oh, we've finished above you for the last 3 years. It's just about bragging rights for these two at the moment. It's just massive.
Do you think the players care that much? Mm. Do you think so?
Yeah, they feel it. They do. They always say that. They always say you can feel when that atmosphere is around you, and it sort of transcends, transforms the match in a way. And like you saw, like the celebration when Aubameyang scored the equaliser in the second half, and like I've never seen him look so sort of like furiously pumped up by a goal as that.
It was the same in the 4-2 last year as well. Yeah, the celebrations were mental.
Yeah, you can feel it. I mean, in the ground, it's, as I say, your ears are ringing, the whole thing sort of shaking, and you can really feel it. There's no way the players don't get that too.
Is there are there many Arsenal matches where the players get into like real kind of like scuffles? It seems to happen every time against Tottenham, but just the players just don't really, I don't know, not that they're not up for other games, but it does definitely affect them, doesn't it? The occasion gets to them.
Definitely. I think they have some beef with Burnley, but
right,
but not to the same extent as Stoke. They don't like Stoke, but not to the same extent as Spurs. And yeah, there's always sort of scuffles and things kicking off and Guendouzi trying to wrestle Dele Alli and that sort of thing.
I wanted to ask you, JJ, because this was an interesting tactical battle in the sense that there wasn't much of a tactical battle. There was lots of open spaces. One assumes that maybe Arsenal are due to be better once the likes of Tierney are back holding Bellerin. Do you think that's true? Do you think there was too much space? Why was there so much space? Where's the balance?
Well, the problem Spurs have had in recent weeks is that they play very narrow and don't have any width, and then they're wide forwards come inside and they're playing against teams who sit deep against them, they can't create, and Eriksen's not been playing, so they've missed that kind of player. Arsenal are trying to work out what they are this season. They adapt to everyone they play against, so they tweak it here and there. The first time he's played is, Unai Emery's played his front three, the Pepe, Aubameyang and Lacazette trio, was against Spurs. And it was interesting that it's sort of similar to how Liverpool line up, and it was a very narrow front three. So generally, if you play a 4-3-3, you'd have the three central forwards, the two wide ones, would be in wide positions most of the time. But the way he wanted to attack was to have those three through the middle and have the fullbacks get really high and wide to support. So you still could, most teams attack with five in the final third. And doing that with the two wide and the three in the middle. But then behind them, you had the three very like kind of ball-winning midfielders. So you had Xhaka just making short passes and fouls, and you had the other two just trying to win the ball and protect the defence, because obviously if you've got three protecting a two, that helps if the fullbacks are high and wide. But I'm not sure it quite worked, because Spurs kind of figured them out quite early. They maybe didn't target Davinson Sanchez on the left as much as they could have done. I think he did okay.
I always bow to JJ on tactical things, but I think from what I could see and from what Emery seemed to be saying to the players on the pitch, the issue was that you had obviously Torreira and Guendouzi to either side of Xhaka. So when Pepe was running off and doing his thing, Torreira was coming out to the right to cover him, mm-hmm. and then Guendouzi was doing the same for Aubameyang. And that meant that Xhaka was on his own in the middle, which, as anyone who's seen Arsenal at all in the last sort of three seasons would tell you, that is a bad place to be, because Xhaka is just, you know, I mean, Son was just walking past him with ease, and he's just not, he needs someone next to him at all times, really, and because he's not got the mobility to protect the defence.
Well, that's why I thought it was meant to be a block, and maybe it's something they've only worked on just quite recently and haven't quite figured out, because it should be that the player that goes forward is the ball side player, not so much to cover the fullback space, but just to be there in case of a break, because then you should have the other two the other side. So one goes forward, the other two are still there protecting the back four. But like I say, I think it must be something they need to work on in training a bit and develop, because it makes perfect sense. You look at Liverpool, the way they do it. So their midfielders are kind of box to box, largely kind of ball winners. Like, so you've got Fabinho sits as a six between the defence and midfield, and links things there. And then Gini Wijnaldum will get box-to-box. And say Henderson is sort of a ball winner, I would say, is what his role is. And that's pretty much what Emery was going for in this game. But they are far better drilled and have done it for far longer. So that would make sense why it didn't work the way that Emery wants it to. But I think once this front three gets things going, that would be a way to do it.
What about the fullbacks, Annie? The Spurs ones? It just seems like, you know, Danny Rose, probably should have just punted that ball out before creating danger for himself and the rest of the team. I know that people don't want to obviously criticize him because, you know, there was a lot of movement after that. But why didn't they address this fullback problem?
Well, in theory, they did. And that was just by getting rid of Kieran Trippier, who I think everyone will agree it was time he moved on. It was a good deal to get rid of him. The idea was that Kyle Walker-Peters would step up into the first team. Juan Foyth has had some experience playing at right back, and those two would kind of compete for right back. The frustrating thing is that Kyle Walker-Peters has been Tottenham's next right back for about 4 years now. And he just should have spent one of these past few seasons on loan at another club. I don't know why on earth he wasn't on loan at, say, Bournemouth last season, who needed a right back. I think they got Nathaniel Clyne in the end, but he ended up out for the whole season injured. But a club like that, why not get him some Premier League experience at another club? Instead, he played three games, got battered at Barcelona. It was quite like a horrible thing to watch, seeing him fall apart at Barcelona. And now, all of a sudden, he's Tottenham's first choice right back, competing with Juan Foyth, who's a centre back. The other crazy thing is Tottenham have also got a £24 million right back on the bench yesterday, Serge Aurier, but he's a lost cause, it seems. So it's just a bit of a crazy situation. Gone from having Kyle Walker and Danny Rose as the two fullbacks, providing so much attacking threat, so much pace and width, to two youngsters competing with not much Premier League experience. Danny Rose is not the player he once was. Injuries have been a bit of an issue for him. Ben Davies, I don't know, he's just never going to be the player that takes Tottenham to the next level. So yeah, it's quite frustrating. But I think with obviously Sessegnon to come through, Pochettino would probably argue that the fullback problem was addressed in the summer. But it looks right now that it hasn't been addressed properly.
But Sessegnon's really not a left back for Pochettino,
long
is he?
Long term.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't imagine Pochettino saying any problem was addressed this summer, given his mood over the last few weeks.
Yeah.
Although he did say yesterday that as of today, so Monday, the European deadline, once that passes, he says we're back drawing a line under the summer of turmoil and disunity.
Why is he always so surprised? I mean, I feel like when he signed that contract, surely he knows what's the deal at Spurs and he knows how Daniel Levy operates. So I'm always a little bit shocked when he's so shocked and how things are.
It can still be frustrating though, can't it? Mm. I agree. He shouldn't be surprised, but it is frustrating. But I suppose also with the right back situation, I don't really know who you go out and buy. There was a limit to how much Tottenham could spend on a right back. 20 million gets you a Kieran Trippier. We don't need another Kieran Trippier.
We've had that one.
You know, Atletico seem to love him over there.
Yeah. Oh, he's a good player, but It was time to go.
Yeah, you seem really thrilled about that. Okay, let's move on to the rest of the Premier League. And I feel like it was this weekend was an ode to some good attacking players, some great strikers. And we have to start off with, obviously, Aguero, because Manchester City obviously cruised past Brighton. I do love Brighton this year. And Pep singled out Aguero for praise. Can he keep on scoring like this? And is he the best striker we have in the league?
That's tough. He might be. Like, there's a few great players in the league who play up front. You've got Aubameyang, I think, is fantastic. And then I suppose you include like Sadio Mane in there as well. He's not a centre-forward, technically. Harry Kane, yeah, he goes in there. Yeah. But Aguero has consistently scored a stupid amount of goals over seasons. I should have checked this stat, but I don't have one. But he scored like over 20 goals only behind someone like, it's like five times he's done it or something, and only like, this is a stupid stat. Basically, he's really good. on a par really statistically with players like Shearer and things like that for the amount he scores. And to have done so consistently is great. And he's definitely improved under Pep Guardiola, mostly off the ball and where he presses and how he helps lead triggers for the way that Man City close down other players. And he didn't start the season either.
Is it Pep that made him better, or is it the system that made him better?
Well, it's coaching, because you can't make the system work unless you have coaching on the training ground to work with the team. But he didn't start the season. Like, he wasn't in the... He didn't start against... Who was the first game they played?
West Ham,
yeah, he didn't start. And then he got into the team against Spurs, I think, yeah. And then he played again against Bournemouth. So I wonder why, maybe it's just a little wake-up call he gets now and again from Guardiola. But Jesus was doing okay in his position. But he is, I mean, everyone agrees now, surely, that he is one of the best the Premier League's had. and he will absolutely keep it up all season long. And he does tend to go in little bursts and then get injured, and takes a while to get back into it.
His technique, his intellect, I think he's one of the best in Europe.
That finish in the top corner on Saturday
was outrageous. No backlift
whatsoever. Yeah. His legs are just tree trunks, aren't they? So powerful.
Oh, the jealousy.
He's also got that very squat. He's got that very squat body, the same as the Messi has, which is your legs are really short, but also really wide. Like his centre of gravity is really low. A bit like Hazard, a bit like Messi.
Like he's being compressed. Like he's a compressed player.
It's all gone into his bum.
Like that Evian bottle that you push. Sergio scored goals when he was at Argentina at 16 years old, and he will die scoring goals, said Pep. What do you guys think about the injury to Laporte? Huge loss, right?
Mm. Yeah, it's crazy. Talk about Spurs not solving their right-back problem. City should have done something about their centre-backs, surely, to lose Vincent Kompany and not replace him in the summer.
Well, they were looking at Maguire, weren't they? But
well, yeah,
they did want to pay the money that United.
That's fair enough. That's fair enough. But he's not the only centre back there is. No. And now all of a sudden they've just got Otamendi.
Stones
is injured,
and obviously Fernandinho came in and because he's quality, just slots straight in there and does a job. But against the top team, you wouldn't want Fernandinho there really, starting there.
Laporte injury didn't look great, did it? What if they end up going into the Champions League group stages with Fernandinho playing at centre-back? Not brilliant, is it?
They could do it, though. I mean, I think they'd be okay. They've also got that young centre-back, Spanish. Is it Eric Garcia? I think he's a centre-back. Yeah, the youngster who, again, they want to bring through players from the youth academy. He's been very highly tipped from my sources, football manager. And he, for a long time now. But
he's highly tipped as well.
Yeah, and if they bought Mike Maguire or whatever for 70 million, which, I mean, he's a good player, but it's stupid money. You could just turn with a bit of coaching, you can turn Garcia into someone who's worth 30, 40, and then the next year he's worth something stupid.
I agree completely, but there's no way Pep Guardiola is going to do that.
No, I think you're probably right, yeah.
And honest,
I don't think Fernandinho's that bad, as a centre-back.
The great Laporte suffers in a one-on-one when they put him against, for example, Son in the Champions League. And I just worry, because he plays such an attacking style of football, that defensively, when you've got people like Fernandinho and it's a Champions League game and there's no Laporte, there's no other good centre-back to put.
Otamendi's not the most calming influence, is he?
He is. Otamendi, weirdly, is really high every year in things like passes and touches. I know, because he's a centre-back, so he's always got the ball. But he is always involved in play. He looks for the ball, doesn't hide. And he is something of a leader on the pitch. And because City always have more of the ball, even in Champions League games, especially in the group stages, I think the more important thing for them is that they can have someone in the air who can clear away headers for crosses, like stuff like that. And they've got, I've forgotten his name already, the new midfielder who goes...
Rodri.
So they've got Rodri, who's adds some height to set pieces when they're defending those, and they can play Walker, can actually cover at centre-back as well.
That's what I was going to say. I wonder if Walker maybe is the... Yeah. They've got João Cancelo, who's obviously barely played, and he's an extremely good fullback who costs lots of money.
And what's more important is they have someone who can play the ball. So if they put Fernandinho there, it's sort of what he did with Mascherano and Martinez at Barca and Bayern. So it suits the kind of thing he'd be thinking. I agree, he didn't expect to lose Laporte for however long he's out for, but should be good.
I mean, it's a good thing that their Champions League group is not a terribly difficult one,
and their I think their Premier League run's actually quite favourable as well.
Norwich, Watford, Everton, Wolves, Palace, Villa, Southampton.
Yes, I'm correct.
So, and it's like, you see? Well, Liverpool, however, on the other hand, are looking rather tremendous. I don't think anyone didn't imagine it. They started off the season really well. A lot of us thought that perhaps they might be feeling some of the pain of fatigue, but it either hasn't kicked in yet or it won't, hopefully. Great work rate, terrific understanding between the teammates, then the Sadio Mane tantrum. By the way, I just want to let you know, that's in my script, okay? So, anyway.
Deflecting away from the hate.
Yes, I am. But tell me, what was that about?
Sadio Mane is getting wound up because Mo Salah doesn't pass to him in obvious opportunities to pass and instead goes for the shot. And he's done it a lot over the last two seasons. There's an example that in the last game they're playing, rather than pass to Mane, who is clearly in space about 5-10 yards to his left and has a tap in as long as he passes it, he uses him as a decoy and tries to tuck it inside to shoot in his right and is easily tackled. And Mane got substituted and was absolutely furious. because this has happened many times. They pointed out in Match the Day 2 last night, actually, that I think the number is something like 47 chances created by Mane for Salah, and I think it's 23 for, I really hope this is correct, for, by Salah for Mane. And they're playing together. Mane has 7 assists for Salah, and I think Salah has 3 or 4 for Mane the other way around. It's, you know, this seems like small numbers, but it should be far more because Mane is always in the right position to receive these passes. And Salah doesn't pass. I mean, you'd see it a lot when you play fives and sevens and there's some guy who thinks he's the boy and then just won't pass. And then at some point you start going, well, do you know what? I'm not going to bother running up alongside you because I'm not going to get the ball off you. You just pass to them and let them go. And I wonder if that's starting to creep into Mane now. He's like, well, I don't want to, if I'm always here and I'm not getting the ball, it's so unrewarding. It's infuriating. And you'd be wound up, right?
Do you think that's what it is, that he won't make the run anymore? Or do you think that he will no longer assist him?
No, I think he's an absolutely fantastic footballer and will keep going every single time. But imagine the amount of effort it takes to sprint and like use that pace to get there every single time. And then yet again, he's not getting the ball. It would make you go nuts.
Yeah, I agree. The thing you should say is, if you kind of making the five-a-side comparison, if it was me and you playing and I kept not passing to
and
you,
it is just like that.
And you were getting annoyed, I would eventually, it would start playing on my mind and I'd think, right, actually, I need to start passing to JJ because he's getting really annoyed about this. But Mo Salah doesn't need to think that, but he should just be good enough to know when he should and when he shouldn't. It's fair enough if he doesn't pass every time, or like maybe the one against Burnley was a really bad one, but there are plenty of times when he should just go himself. But he just needs to be able to, his decision making at those times is just like a little bit off.
Exactly, and that's what separates him from being in the very top tier of, I think, like world footballers. So like things like Messi and like Messi or De Bruyne just know exactly when to make the pass and when the opportunity to shoot is. And I think that, I mean, it makes me angry thinking about it.
Can we talk briefly about Roberto Firmino?
That's what I wanted to say. What a performance.
You sound like Jurgen Klopp.
Let's not talk about this. deflect. First Brazilian to reach 50 goals in the Premier League. And I would put forward that he is the best Brazilian player to ever play in the Premier League. And I can't...
Have you got any other contenders?
The other contenders would be Fernandinho, who's been very good for a long time.
Yeah.
Coutinho, who hit heights that I think were very high, but probably not long enough. And then Gilberto Silva.
What about the Manchester City forward?
Gabriel Jesus.
No.
Robinho.
Batista.
Batista. They feed some really bad ones, haven't they?
Yeah.
I guess actually Daphne Ruiz is probably high up on the list.
We're in danger of turning this podcast into a Sporkle
this
quiz.
Is fun.
Oh, I love Sporkle.
That's what people want, JJ.
Let's roll with it.
But yeah, I think, honestly, I think Firmino is, I mean, obviously, Mane and Salah get more headlines because they score goals and that's how headlines work. But he is just the most unbelievably good player.
Yeah, I do think that players like these types of number nines who do so much in the final third, the way that they feed the others, the way that they pull back, their tactical intelligence, just he's been amazing for Brazil. He's been amazing for Liverpool. And sometimes I always wonder why people don't name them as some of the best number nines in the world. And I have this issue with Karim Benzema because I just look at him and I think, wow, you're so smart. And then they just come up for all this criticism because they don't score as much as all the other players or whatever it is. But it's what they do in the final third that's so effective. And I just cannot imagine Liverpool without Firmino.
There's some great stuff from Jurgen Klopp afterwards talking about when Gini Wijnaldum played in Firmino's position against Barcelona last year. I think Firmino was injured. Mm. And basically came off the pitch, Wijnaldum, and just turned to Firmino and said, how on earth do you do this? Like, what am I doing right now? And Firmino, you know, Wijnaldum's a really bright, versatile, sort of adaptable player. And he just like couldn't even begin to fathom how Firmino does it. So I think that's quite a good measure of how good he really is.
Well, just a nod to Karim Benzema as well. Anyway, moving on to Manchester United. Was anyone really shocked by the fact that they drew again?
No.
Anyone shocked by Dan James being the goal scorer again?
I think it's nice that he's the goal scorer again, and it was some hit, like a rocket into the top corner. Man United are worryingly average to the point they that squad came out, and the first team lineup came out, and the substitutes to the bench, and you're going, that's like a team that finishes 10th with Pogba in it. And it's really odd. I don't think Solskjaer's won a game away from home since he took charge, has he?
No, he has. He won the first game, winning run.
The first game?
He won the first game, that was against Cardiff. He won loads in a row, having a nightmare today. but you're right, at the end of last season, now the start of this season, the form has massively dipped off, so you're definitely right.
Good stat about that, if you guys want it.
Tell us.
So since February the 24th, when United drew with Liverpool, they've kept only one clean sheet in 15 Premier League games. That's the same number as Aston Villa and Sheffield United, who obviously were only promoted this season. In that time, Everton have kept 10 clean sheets. So that's 9 more than United. It's just, I think, as they showed against Chelsea, in attack, they've got some really, really good players. They've got lots of talent. It's a matter of just getting them playing well together more consistently. But in defence, there's just something more fundamentally wrong than just being able to be solved by signing Harry Maguire for £80 million.
On Lindelof. Is he the fundamentally wrong thing?
Well,
I've got some more stats if you want another potential answer. So I just think they're putting a square peg in a round hole by trying to make Scott McTominay their defensive midfielder. Paul Pogba, we've seen time and again, can't do that job. He needs a defensive midfielder alongside him. When United were kind of like their most defensively solid, I don't think they should go back to this because they were boring, but they had Nemanja Matic playing there, who was far better, a defensive midfielder. So when you look at tackles per game by McTominay compared to other big six defensive midfielders, McTominay is making 1.5 per game, Fabinho 3.3, Rodri 4, Jorginho 2.8, even Guendouzi 2.3. He's just not a defensive midfielder, and it just leaves the centre-backs too open. And Harry Maguire is a good enough defender to make Manchester United much better, but I do think something more fundamental needs to change with the way they're playing.
Yeah, his entire team.
Is that tackling midfield thing not an indication of those other teams' press, like Fabinho, Rodri, Guendouzi, all play for teams that try and get opposition faces and try and win the ball, whereas United are quite, despite Solskjaer's attempts to make them a bit more high intensity, they still seem to me very sluggish off the ball.
I'm not sure it would, because the press would then make the other team clear, is the whole point, and then you win the ball in midfield, and Fernandinho would often be deep at halfway and wouldn't. So I think he breaks up play rather than is the one who wins the ball from the press, if that makes sense. Mm. I think the Man United, you saw it, like they took the lead. They don't manage the game very well. Pogba turned up and was half asleep, it seemed like. He was caught in possession so many times.
He has so many of these games.
Man, he's so frustrating because he's what a great player he is, but he can't do it consistently and system not switched on. I totally agree with the McTominay point, and you think they have to play in a three, but then it doesn't seem to work. He wants to play James wide right, and he's got Rashford through the middle. Juan Mata was, I thought, completely quiet, but apparently created more chances than anyone before he got taken off.
That run that he made for Dan... It's amazing. It's just his intellect in the final third can be
Well, Matt's movement is one of the things that makes him so good, but he's not very quick anymore. So
no, he was never really quick before, even when he was at the height of his brilliance.
Man United are this sort of team that I think will finish in the top 10. They'll be good. They've got great players. The great individual players will win them games and get them points. But this season looks a little, to me, almost like, you know when Leicester won the league, because everyone else kind of had a bit of a nightmare and fell apart. It's almost like below the top two, maybe Spurs is in third, it's so open that it's like one of those seasons where there could be a change because there's not enough quality or consistency in the top teams. Chelsea are over the place. Man United, don't know. Wolves should be good. Leicester look really good. Everton should be able to come up. Watford should really kind of sort themselves out. West Ham could get in there as well. Arsenal, I think, are quite decent. But there's so many things that could get in there. It just needs one or two of those teams to take charge, and you could totally change up a top five.
United's next three fixtures: Leicester at home, West Ham away, and Arsenal at home.
Oh, difficult.
I think that's quite a tricky run, that. Particularly Leicester at home. I think they might go there, and Leicester might go there and really fancy themselves.
Do you think there's any chance of them losing patience with Solskjaer? I just think they love him so much.
He's sort of...
This is total speculation, obviously.
he's sort of... What's the word? Sort of fireproofed himself in a similar way to Lampard is doing by focusing so much on the young players and by sort of saying we're trying to bring in a new cycle. You're buying yourself time by doing that. I mean, obviously people like up in the north, like James Ducker, will know far better than me, but I can't imagine them pulling the trigger anytime soon. But equally, if they lose the next three games and suddenly they're in 16th, 17th, it's getting to a point where that combined with their end of the season last time around and Solskjaer's lack of managerial experience to fall back on, alarm bells really would start ringing.
especially because, you know, when you consider the kind of club they are and how much they rely on sponsorship and their brand, I think that that would be a huge own goal for them to keep them going if they keep losing games. But
the thing is, though, like, so on that same note, you have to, all the teams that have come up and been amazing now, City not included because they bought a lot of good players. And then, I mean, they bought the right players, I would have said, is why they are where they are. But look at how long Liverpool sort of floated about, you know, between like seventh and second for so long. They formed a team and worked with it and took it up and improved it every single time. Solskjaer still hasn't really got his team together to even start building towards what he wants. It's such a big job to try and turn them into something. And the good way to do it is to get a core of players who care about the club and are from within the club. And they're trying to bring through these youngsters. I know Wan-Bissaka and James aren't from there, but they're trying to turn it into this unit, which could develop into something, which is far better, kind of, I would say, management-wise, than just dropping a few individual players in and hoping that they'll fit. Because you can form these bonds
on the pitch. No, I get that, but I think that there's a lot of an onus on, okay, you love the club, so you're going to be amazing for it. I don't necessarily think so.
But they'd want to cultivate that culture, and that's what Ferguson had with his players. That's why he could drop in an occasional new signing, because the ethos was there. And you've got to create it, because they lost the whole boardroom. They lost a lot of these players that had that, and then they're trying to recreate it. And I mean, that's incredibly hard to do, and some of the best managers in the world couldn't possibly do it. And you put any manager into that Man United team, and they'd probably finish, you know, not up the top of the table, the very top. So I think that's difficult. But I think you saw the kind of things that, like, Mourinho, when he bought Victor Lindelof, so I think, I'm sure it was Mourinho that bought him. It was 2017 he signed. He came in, didn't play for a while. He got dropped into Huddersfield game because Jones got injured, and he was at fault for two goals, and they were bits of terrible 1v1 defending where he showed too much to Tomins, then showed him the other side, and they ended up scoring. And the second goal that they conceded was a long punt from the goalkeeper. Lindelof had all the time in the world to read the ball drop in, and then tried to head it back to his own goalkeeper, totally made a mess of it, and it went back. And you saw on the weekend that Lindelof not taking responsibility for Yannick Vestergaard just behind him, who, by the way, was the best player on the pitch, absolutely, like, proper dominant centre back performance, and that's the kind of thing that Man United need. Maguire is pointing to look after the player behind him, and Rio Ferdinand pointing this out on BT Sport. I wasn't talking to him, and then Lindelof points as well, as though someone else should do it, but it's his job because he's the other centre back. Maguire's in the right position at the near post to defend it, and these kind of things. This is what they're trying to create at Man United. I think is this ethos where they do take responsibility for things like that, because the only way you're going to win games is by having that extra aggressiveness and competitiveness that'll take them to another level.
Okay, let's rattle through the rest of the games because we've got about 3 minutes before we have to move on. Right, defence, poor showings in defence, and we have to speak about Chelsea. Mm. So do you think that this is something that Lampard can resolve?
I think it's interesting, in particular, lots of talk today about Cesar Azpilicueta and his role in this back four. I mean, he's sort of now he's been such a good player for so long that it feels sort of cruel to criticise him, but he was clearly targeted by Sheffield United this weekend. It was at fault.
And Norwich the week before.
And he's clearly not in keeping with the rest of the team's sort of youth and energetic approach. And you do wonder, Reece James had a great season on loan last year and is clearly a good talent. And you wonder whether a time might come where Lampard's basically, he goes even younger with the team. This week he brought Tomori in, and I think it was Chelsea's youngest ever Premier League team. Whether he goes sort of all eggs in that basket and drops Azpilicueta, who's obviously been great and is generally very reliable. But that would be a concern for them, as well as the fact they remain so open. Like, they've been, it's remarkable how open they've been this season.
The inability to sort of become a compact side once they lose possession.
I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with Lampard wanting to play a young team. I think the problem is that there's been too much change too fast, and in the Premier League that gets punished. Tomori and Zuma could well be a good centre-back pairing, but you've also got Emerson, who didn't play quite so much last season. And then obviously with Azpilicueta's form going off, going down the pan, it's too much for too soon.
Leicester had some moments of terrible defending, but then they've got Jamie Vardy, and just a terrific number nine again. Is he just someone that's going to continue being brilliant, even though he's 32?
I mean, he suddenly became very, very, very fast all of a sudden midway through his 20s. So who knows what he's possible of.
Red Bull.
Can they realistically be one of the sides that pushes for top six?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Leicester brilliant.
Brendan Rodgers is a great manager.
Yeah, and the logic of getting him in early before the summer is sort of becoming more and more obvious with each week. And you look at that team now, and it's so strong throughout. And even Kagla Soyuncu, who, forgive me if I pronounced that terribly, who's come in and replaced Harry Maguire. And he's been brilliant at this start of the season. And they've got a midfield there with Tielemans, who at £40 million is an absolute steal. Like, I can't believe no one else came in for him and that Leicester would be able to basically sign him unopposed. With Maddison in there, Ndidi seems to be going from strength to strength. Hamza Chowdhury is a really sort of combative, physical player. And then up front, obviously, Vardy's doing the business. The only thing I don't get about Leicester is why they signed Ayoze Perez. Like, I just don't really see it with him. I never really have. He had a good month last season, and that's pretty much it for his entire time in Newcastle. They've got Harvey Baines.
Their fullbacks are really good as well.
I think Chilwell's brilliant.
Chilwell and Pereira. Mm. Ricardo.
Have you noticed how beautiful Callum Wilson is? Like, in his face, I was just watching him do his interview after the match.
He's
a
very good looking man.
I've never seen someone with such a clear face. But anyway, what about Everton? They've won their last six at home in the Premier League, and Marco Silva seems to be finally getting it right there.
They're just so inconsistent, though. Yeah. They lost to Aston Villa last week. Mm. Just, they're really good signing Moise Kean, correct pronunciation?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Seems like a really good shout. They needed to improve on Dominic Calvert-Lewin. I also think replacing Bernard's very good, but his end product's absolutely atrocious.
Famous delivery.
Wobi scored.
He scored.
It's two and two in two games.
Exactly.
They
did need to improve in those areas, and they have. And their defence, as I mentioned earlier, seems really good. But they still just, there's something just not quite right. They're still
really boring. Do you think? Like, they're really boring to watch. That Wolves game was terrible. Like, the first 10 minutes was great.
Really?
Yeah, I thought it was really boring.
3-2.
Yeah, what more do you want? 3-2, yeah. Red card.
This sounds so stupid, saves. But apart from the goals, honestly, I thought it was really boring.
Oh, man, after my own heart.
AJ prefers a tactical 0-0.
I do
yes,
not.
Because that's the right way to play football.
I don't agree they're boring. I just think they are inconsistent. And so I think if you were to ask, you're not asking me, but if you were to ask me whether Leicester or Everton are more likely to break into the top six, I would say Leicester.
Hello, podcast listeners. My name's Danny Boyle, and I'm The Telegraph's Commuter Editions editor, which means it's my job to provide you with great journalism that makes your journey to and from work as enjoyable as possible. I can't prevent train delays or guarantee you won't get caught in the rain, but I can make sure you're up to date with the best of The Telegraph every morning and evening. And I just wanted to let you know about one of the ways you can get all that in audio form. All you need to do is join my WhatsApp group. Every weekday, my colleague Chris Price and I bring you short audio briefings directly to your smartphone at 8 in the morning and 5:30 in the afternoon. And the best bit? It's completely free to sign up and easy. Just click on the link in the show notes for this episode. I look forward to having you as a group member soon.
If you were just to end it here, please. If Aston Villa, you know, should they feel really aggrieved at the moment?
Oh, I think that's genuinely one of the worst decisions I've ever seen in the Premier League.
It's just hideous, really? Isn't
it's
it?
It's just disgusting.
Like, just let it go and let it go to VAR.
What happened? So they scored a goal and the referee pulled it back.
No. So Grealish charged through, did his Grealish thing, sort of went through two or three players, and then he passes the ball off to Lansbury. Was it Lansbury who scored?
Yeah.
Yeah, to Lansbury who scores.
Good finish.
Just after he's passed the ball off, he sort of falls as he passes the ball, and you're allowed to go on the floor. You're allowed to do that. You're allowed to fall over after you pass the ball, because clearly he was off balance a bit or whatever.
And he's passing to his teammate.
I think, yes, terrible decision. One tiny thing, which I hope I don't get slated for. I think Grealish, there's a tiny, 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 even if it's just sort of preempting a bit of impact, there's a tiny twist in his turn, as if he's like, which in the replays make it look a little bit like he's ready to fall. Mm. And that just gives the referee a decision.
So he's fallen a bit dramatically.
A tiny, tiny, tiny bit. And like, I don't think it should have been a goal. It was a penalty. It was a foul. So if he was going to call it back and do something, then it should have been a penalty rather than a disallowed goal. But I just think Grealish didn't help himself with that tiny little...
But he pulled it back for a disallowed goal to give him a free kick.
No, he blew the whistle for immediately.
Yeah. So after Jack Grealish fell.
Before the ball went in the net. And that was a problem, because that meant that VAR couldn't go back and say,
That's the weird part with the VAR thing. So you think if he wasn't sure, you could let it run, then you could go.
Exactly.
But that's not part of
that's
it.
That's what he should have done.
I've watched that like the foul or the dive about 20 times just on repeat. And every time I think a little bit differently about it. I think at full speed, I think it looks like Jack Grealish is looking for a free kick and throws himself to the ground. Not throws, but tactically falls. And he does this a lot in games where he throws his back to someone because he knows the contact's coming and he goes down and he wins free kicks all of the time. And he got done a couple of times, I think it was a couple of weeks ago, when he got the I can't remember who he was playing against, but he did it. The referee didn't buy it. The other team stole the ball and ended up scoring.
Spurs,
there we go. And I think that is, maybe his reputation precedes him. And the referee sees him doing that same thing again in the closing, well, not closing, but, you know, the important stage of the game. And I can see why it should stop.
You're allowed to fall over as you pass.
Okay, let's move on to England. We're going to be here all day. Okay. Any surprise inclusions or omissions from the England squad? We know, obviously, they face not too many tough teams, but Bulgaria could prove a bit of a test. So who are you surprised by Southgate including and... not including.
I think Kyle Walker being left out was the obvious high profile.
Yeah, but they have so much talent at right back, right?
Still. Yeah, I think if this was against Spain and Germany, I think Walker would be in that team. But I think it makes sense to try some of the younger guys out, particularly Wan-Bissaka, who's obviously started quite well, not brilliantly, but started quite well at Man United. So he was the one. I also find it quite amusing how Fabian Delph was in the England squad for what felt like a long, long time, despite never playing for City. And now he's actually started playing really well for Everton. He's fallen out of the England squad. But again, I think that's because Oxlade-Chamberlain's come in and he...
Is the idea of Delph better than actual Delph?
The concept, yeah. I think, yeah, Oxlade-Chamberlain back into full fitness, well, slowly. And obviously he was a big part of that team before he got injured. So I can see the logic there, but I do feel a bit for Delph.
Do you think Lingard still warrants a place in that side?
Yeah, I think Lingard's a good player. I think he's maybe not top tier elite, but he gives you lots of options. Seems like a nice lad, and he does score and assist now and again. No, he doesn't.
He never scores. He never assists.
What's going on with your stats today?
I don't know. I like Lingard. I think he's a decent enough player. I don't think he's good enough for, like, in Premier League terms, a team in the top 10. I think he's a squad player at a top 4. England, I think that's pretty much what England are. They're not one of the best teams in the world. They're sort of maybe top 10, top 12-ish.
Yeah, I think with, like, Lingard, he's now an England squad player rather than an England starter. For me, I think he's just on the cusp, maybe one of the first subs.
So what's Kieran Trippier?
In the bin.
Sorry, Kieran. Sorry, this is
I don't hate him. He listens every week.
I don't hate him that much. He's now somehow in an England squad. He's fourth choice England right back.
Right.
Is that wrong?
Got a lot of time for Trippier going out to Atletico Madrid, and he started really well there in a completely different style of team, different culture.
Really understands Morata. Delivers for him perfectly.
Yeah, and his delivery has always been good. It's the other stuff that's been a problem. And there was obviously, it was no coincidence that his best performances for England came as a wing back rather than a right back when he had Walker behind him. But I can't see how he gets in ahead of Alexander-Arnold, because
whose delivery is equally good.
It's wonderful.
And he offers probably a bit more
defensive
all round.
It sounds like Southgate just wants to make sure that he knows he's still his pal. So he's inviting him in to let him. It's like, I think he said, we're just letting him know that we're still thinking of him.
Yeah.
And that's why he's in the squad.
Well, so he should be rewarded for going. He played for Atletico Madrid, who are the best teams in Europe, and he's a starting right back, and he's doing really well. I mean, we would be in any other country, they think it's weird that he's not in the team, but we've obviously got so many right backs that it's just the sort of weird modern way.
It's a country full of right backs.
It is.
But I'm happy for Wan-Bissaka. Do you think Bulgaria will provide a good test?
No. Not really.
Right. I love how much faith you have in those teams. Now, JJ, this is a Scottish roundup, and in that I'm going to ask you a solitary question. Celtic destroyed Rangers? Would you feel that that's an accurate way of putting it?
No, I don't think they destroyed them, but they did them with a fairly basic counter-attack setup. Rangers are very good at passing the ball in their own half, but as we've seen from Steven Gerrard's team all this season, they don't seem to really know how to create. He spent a lot of money, a lot of wages on some big players, and none of them seem to be turning up. Joe Aribo started in this game and was totally out of it. Just couldn't get involved in the play. He was out he's playing like a 4-3-2-1. So it's a very narrow shape with no width. The hope had been that Tavernier, who plays at right back, can get forward and give them some width. But Celtic were just waiting to launch counterattacks in there and had Mikey Johnson on the left, who's very good with the ball. Rangers this season have scored most of their goals from like set pieces. They put, I think it was, they put six or seven past Hibs. But other than that, like they beat Kilmarnock narrowly with two goals from corners. They only managed to beat St Mirren because of a free kick from 25 yards. I don't know if Steven Gerrard's quite got a plan on how to create things in the opposition half. I don't know whether that's because his way of working with them on the training ground or what he wants from them doesn't allow for that kind of play. Like a lot of their forward play is just chipping the ball towards someone, but you've got Jermaine Defoe up front. Or like Morelos was on the bench and he's the one for breaking behind the lines and doing stuff like that. And this is Gerrard's big year and Rangers have to get close to Celtic. You can't write them off in the title race this season just yet either. But I think Celtic showed that they were far and away and above. I mean, there are more teams in Scotland.
I know.
Yeah. It's an interesting league this year, actually, because like, there's a few teams. Like, Hearts and Hibs should really be pushing Rangers and Celtic for... not pushing them for a title race, but you've got Hibs, Hearts, Aberdeen, you'd think, should be in amongst it. Hearts and Hibs have started terribly, really, really awful. There might be managerial changes at both coming up. Motherwell are kind of a surprise. Livingston have started surprisingly well. Kilmarnock have fallen away a bit from last season. They finished third last season, which is a bit of a surprise. And they've got Antonio Conte's ex-assistant manager.
I know,
as their manager, Angelo Alessio, he's done okay. You'd hope with Rangers and Celtic both qualifying for Europa League that they'll win a few of those games and it helps the glorious coefficient try and restore some sort of semblance of pride back to Scottish football. But, I mean, I swear, it is a good league. It's really fun.
But it's not as exciting as Europe.
Well, that derby, not as good yesterday as the North London derby, but if you wanted to watch one game for the rest of your life, Rangers-Celtic wouldn't be a
Ali,
bad...
Ali, I have so many to just come back for.
It's always exciting.
The derby. Lazio-Roma is a better derby, and that was over the weekend.
We're coming to that, I think. But
if you'd give me a chance.
But that game is terrible quality, but it's exciting, isn't it? It's always exciting.
Yeah, but then this is the thing. It's a bubble, and I think a lot of people down in England especially seem to think that that's still the thing. And I, up in Scotland, other than people who live in the West Coast, and it is a bubble, honestly, don't care. Like, I don't care about Rangers and Celtic. Honestly, if it went away, great, it'd be amazing. Huh. All the nonsense comes along with it.
Huh, right. Alicey? No one cares. Not even Scottish people care. Right, it's my moment now, and it's a song for Europe. We sadly have now a minute and a half to go through this, but it's also the section where I end up talking to myself, because today I'm the host, and I'm the one who responds to my own questions. So we start off with Juventus and Napoli, which was the big game in Serie A. I don't know if any of you care about that, but this was just one of those amazing games. I mean, if you wanted to see bad defending, it was astonishing, because Juventus were criticised for not starting Matthias de Ligt, who is obviously the most expensive centre-back that they've ever bought last week. And that was because Sarri wasn't on the bench and they didn't want to throw him in the deep end. Now, Chiellini's out with ACL. They had to throw him in the deep end. And he was at fault for basically everything. And
that's very harsh.
You have to feel sorry for him, because I just feel like it's a different league. It's a different way of defending. And he was really thrown in there, and he wasn't really aided by the rest of his teammates. You really feel Chiellini's absence when he's not there. So this was a game where Juventus went through to 3-0, and then Napoli came back in 16 minutes, made it 3-3. And sadly for them, probably the best centre-back in the league, in Koulibaly, scored an own goal to make it 4-3 for Juventus. And it was really sweet, because Chiellini hobbled over at the end of the game and just consoled Koulibaly for scoring that own goal and giving all the points to Juventus. Then, of course, there was the Rome derby. Now, that's a great derby. This was a fantastic game between two sides that were just so good going forward, but sadly not very good at scoring. So they hit the woodwork between them, I think, six times. Four for Lazio, twice for Roma, 1-1 in the end, but so much drama. Absolutely fantastic to watch. Please try to get the reverse fixture, and you have to watch that. Meanwhile, Barcelona had the youngest ever goal scorers come on for them and make an instant impact. Ansu Fati, he's 16 years old. They were playing Osasuna. There was no Luis Suarez, there was no Dembele, and there was no Lionel Messi. But he got the equaliser after Osasuna went and scored a goal. And now he's very much the kid to watch. If you remember Ronaldinho, he's not too different. Really good at getting past this man. Just terrific delivery. Such a good head on his shoulders. A wonderful player. So watch out for him.
Does he play in the same position?
Remember the name. Winger.
Winger.
Mm-hmm.
Was he fast? Likes to dribble inside?
Absolutely. So fast, so good at getting past his man. Doesn't feel the pressure of the situation or anything that's around him. So devoted to his football. And he makes you feel that. You know, when you have that smile on your face when you watch Ronaldinho, you kind of get the same. He's just such a good kid. And of course, the biggest game that happened over the weekend was Union Berlin against Dortmund, because they defeated them 3-1 to get their first victory in the Bundesliga. I'm sure you've heard a lot about Union Berlin. They're a side, only the fifth former East German club to reach the Bundesliga. And this is a team that's just been so well managed financially, on the pitch, off the pitch. Their fans contributing labor and money to help modernize the stadium in 2008. They're now obviously in the Bundesliga after working so hard to get there. And of course, their first win came against Lucien Favre's Dortmund. They scored a goal. Dortmund came back, and then they got two more as Dortmund started pouring men forward. They left spaces, and it was just a fantastic game. But that's all we have from Europe.
No time for a song for Gareth Bale. Last night, two goals.
Yes, fantastic.
He did two goals.
Huh?
And a red card.
And a red card. It was a harsh red card.
That's the best hat trick you can get.
Two goals, he's back.
He's never gone away, but I'm glad that...
It's nice to see him doing well, though, isn't it?
It is nice. And everyone's nice that Zidane is playing him and giving him that chance.
It is.
It means he won't be moving today, because obviously we're recording this on a Monday. And the transfer deadline window for European clubs
hasn't
closes.
Been sold in the time since we started this.
Yeah. Well, Scottish Premiership, you know. If you're listening, Gareth.
Let's see. Hopefully now tonight we can finally see Pochettino having a good night's sleep and potentially Cardi reaching PSG. Okay, that's it from us. We'll be back next Monday. Contact the podcast, afcpodcast@telegraph.co.uk, and we'll read out the best of what you send us. To subscribe to the podcast, search for Telegraph Audio Football Club. Thank you and bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.